Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
Before I hit play, if you'd like to take a look at the article that's written by James Webb, you can go to jameswebb.com, or you can go to the All Marine Radio website, and it is on the read board, right? So if you click on the link that you find there, I just put it up there. If you care to follow along, you will. It's right at the top. So just go to the read board and click on that link, and it will take you to. It'll take you to the article written by a former Secretary of the Navy, former senator from Virginia, former platoon commander in Vietnam. And so it's there. So with that said, stand by. Normally that music is emblematic of the Lynch and Kenny event, and it is today. Joining us from McAllen, Texas is Tim Lynch. Timmy, how you doing?
I'm doing just great, Mac. How are you?
I'm all right. And joining us from Southern California is the man, the myth, the legend himself, Mr. Indestructible, Jeff Kenny. Jeff, how are you?
Great. How you doing, Mac?
I'm all right. And in his debut appearance in the Lynch, Kenny, and Vito show is Will Costantini. The last time we did this, anything like this, was in like 1991 or 1992. Will, what's going on?
Not a lot. Yeah, I was just, when you said the debut, I was thinking this debuted a long time ago, and it didn't last a week off Broadway, so I'm not sure what we're doing here.
No, but it was a good time. We were talking before we came on the air, and, you know, So there's a bunch of us, captain, lieutenants, and we wouldn't let field grade officers come because they'd always ruin everything. So,
except Colonel Wiley, we let him.
Yeah, Colonel Wiley, we would. But I had colonels call, and it was called the MUCUS, the Marine Corps University All Society, right. And we called it ours MUCUS. And I can't remember, somebody from Mainside called me and said, "Hey, Mac, I'm Lieutenant Colonel so-and-so. I'd really like to come to your thing. I heard it's good. Sorry, sir, can't come. No field grade officers." What? Yeah. No,
that was great.
No field grade officers.
That was Lieutenant Colonel Berger.
Oh, maybe. Damn it. Maybe. And so he said, "Well, why not?" I said, "Because they always fuck everything up, right? They always try to put us at the position of attention and pull out the yellow and tell us we don't know what we're talking about. So, you know, just don't." And they're like, "Oh, okay. Are you sure? Well, you know, if you reconsider. You know, if we change anything, I'll let you know. But for right now, it's just company grade officers." And we'd present papers and argue and stuff like that and write and stuff like that. But I was talking, one of my favorite things to do is say, "That's fucking bullshit," right? And in this group of incendiary individuals, it didn't take much to get it going. That always would, though. And so, we will attempt to stay away from that because I'm not sure. Well, I could say it. It's mostly said more for effect than for actual truth, but whatever. Let's talk about Jim Webb's letter, his op-ed piece that it ran in the National Interest. He posted it on his webpage. You can go check that out now if you want to. And it's entitled "The Future of the Marine Corps," by former Senator Jim Webb. And Tim, we'll start with you. Your thoughts on Secretary, Senator, former Alpha Company 1-5 warfighter Jim Webb.
Yeah, it's a good article that I just want to pick a certain part of it and throw it out there because in the article he gives a history of the Marine Corps and he makes a very succinct argument for essentially what we've been talking about, which is not changing the entire force structure to focus on one threat in a strategically defensive manner and the folly thereof. But in that article, he starts out talking about the costly blunders and inability to accomplish national objectives. And he basically takes a shot at the General Officers Corps because he then wonders why they're treated with reverence, approaching the esteem of those who led the country to victory in World War II. That's a quote. And I think that this article, because the rest of it is a solid argument, I think it's a shot at what the true problem is. It's a touch at the elephant in the room, and that is the performance of our general officers if you were looking at them from China's perspective. And I would give you just one thing, and then I want to leave this alone. If you're wargaming against the Navy, and you're going to give the Navy a tactical ranking based on their perceived proficiency, if the Navy's forced to inject female crew members into that Navy, do you increase your tactical value or decrease? And I'm not trying to be a dick, but I heard Kurt Schlesinger on a podcast yesterday talking about when he was at the Naval War College, and this had been during the Obama era, that they were given a routine assignment, the colonels, and it was pick the number one threat you think is facing the United States. You brief the threat one day, the next day you brief your COAs. And half the class briefed global warming. And that cannot be lost on our adversaries. And I think it's that kind of nonsense that Webb was pointing at when he started off this thing by taking a subtle swipe at the entire competency of the chain of command, which right now, as you and Vito talked about just the other day, is in serious crisis. And that's the problem. That's the problem.
All right, so what we'll do is we'll just kind of go around. Jeff, any thoughts on what Tim just said?
Yeah, I agree with him. Like, I have to tell you, the whole time we're in Iraq and then Afghanistan, I was there. There was never any published strategy how we should handle or operational design on how we should handle what we're doing, particularly us. I was advising an Afghan brigade commander, before that Iraqi brigade commander. And it was only the guy who owned the local battle space who cared about what you were going to do with, in one case, the Iraqis, in the other case, the Afghans. I'm like, what the fuck, man? When's this? Isn't there some kind of plan? All we get from General Neller was he sent out this like decal. If you saw this on the decal, you're too close to the Hummer in front of you. And if you saw that on the decal, you're too far away. You should see this. It was disheartening. I mean, because I like the guy, But it was like, that's it. Nothing like, let's try and, work these guys into where they're taking a lead in these operations and stuff. No. It was like, the whole thing was get through your 7 months, if you're a battalion level, with as few, as few law of war violations, as few casualties, and as many bullshit medals as you could, and so it was like almost like, a repeat of the 13-month Vietnam thing, except now instead of guys doing it individually, we were doing it by unit. And so I thought a lot of it was lack of interest. I mean, I think we've become so professionalized. The goal is to serve the service, not serve the country. So consequently, you don't want to make waves. You don't want to, it's just as important to go to command and staff if you're a major than it is to go back for another tour in Iraq. It's just as important, for a guy to go get that joint school. So he can get this block checked off. They had guys getting pulled out of command early, in Iraq and then Afghanistan in order to attend some bullshit school. And if the schools were so good, we would have won the goddamn thing by 2005. So, I mean, I agree with Tim. That is a big problem. And it's not getting any better. It's like the whole – we're like a gun-toting DMV community. And that's like, hey, you don't argue if this is the way we do it, and that's the way it is,
Wow. Will, have at it. Your thoughts on what Tim said?
Of interest, I wrote four bullets down on the web thing. Three things that he really talked about, force design, and then the fourth thing is he's taking shots. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't subtle. Tim said subtle. It wasn't subtle. He is taking a shot, and um you know, James Webb is an interesting character. He obviously he's a little bit polarizing in the Marine Corps, to say the least. So this idea of taking shots, it might be his way of trying to open the dialogue that retired GOs in particular don't feel like they can have in public. Because his argument is, you know, the sort of conservative flexibility, balance, kind of thing, but to get people to pay attention, perhaps he takes this shot, and maybe that's really what he's trying to communicate to the commandant today.
Do you think that's his audience for this, the commandant, or is it a different audience?
I think his number one audience is the commandant, and if that doesn't work, and I don't think he has any faith that it will. I mean, the commandant's pretty far down with this. He put it out in his planning guidance, and then he puts his document follow on the planning guidance with here. So the commandant knows where he's going. So this is sort of the way of saying, hey, commandant, here's what I think. And if it doesn't get any traction, then this is a way to rally the troops in opposition. So that's on the surface, the commandant's his audience, but his real audience is people who don't want to publicly take on the commandant. This is a way to rally them to support James Webb's ideas, I think.
Yeah, I thought relative to Timmy, what Timmy says, the shot he takes, I'm very sympathetic with, because we talked about this in terms of the performance of, you know, all these disasters where we have fallen short of the strategic vision that's been laid out as we've gone to war. I mean, we've been escorted there by the flag and the general officers of the United States military. So he's playing to a sympathetic audience with me when he talks about that stuff. And no phase four articulated in Iraq or Afghanistan. So to me, and so that about what Timmy said. But the other thing that I thought was that his ultimate audience is Congress. That's his,
I agree.
That's his, I thought that was his ultimate audience. And, you know, but I do agree with what Will said in that, you know, he's speaking for a lot of people that can't speak. And I think, you know, probably developed this in concert with those people before he hit the send button.
Well, who do you guys think he's actually talking to, like, by name? I mean, who do you think, which big players, like in the Senate or even in the House, you know, do you think they're aiming at? Because that makes sense to me.
I don't know. Maybe Will and I were talking about this the other day, but you know, maybe the incoming Secretary of Navy is one of them.
And there's also guys like Eric Mellinger, when he was working in the Senate Armed Services or House Armed Services Committee. Those guys are going to read everything Webb writes. All right.
His big. I
would say that, you know, the discussion about the GOs, something that I came to realize late on, you know, we have this idea of civilian control, which is a good idea, right? It's sort of a bedrock of the Republic, but it's interpreted inside the building as military subservience.
Right.
You know, Webb references people in World War II. You know, FDR tried to call George Marshall George one time, and Marshall said, it's General Marshall.
Locked him up.
And so he was, you know, much more able to ensure that the military advice was seen, and he was a partner. And I'll tell you, I believe that partnership, at least when I left in 2013, that partnership was way out of balance.
Yeah.
In terms of Articulate why.
In terms of military subservience to civilians. And that included, you know, people, political appointees in OSD, but also to the Hill. The senators and congressmen are important people in, you know, the theory of the government. They represent us, but they are not royalty. And,
you know,
they have trained us through the school system in particular, above command and staff. When you get into war college level, that message of civilian mastery and military subservience is very strong, but it's not overt. It's sort of interesting how that works. And so you get this, global warming is the number one threat. Yeah. No uniformed person in their right mind would have ever come up with that. And anyone that did, George Marshall would have put out on the ice floe and let them melt away, right?
Right.
So that obviously comes from this idea of subservience, because, well, if that's our idea, that's what the idea has to be. Jeff said it very well, and that is it to the service or is it to the nation? So.
Right. Well, you said, you know, you mentioned FDR and Marshall, and the Secretary of War then, Stimson, and the Secretary of the Navy, Forrestal, they knew more about their proper places than anybody probably before or since. They had enough military experience to know that they got to leave it to Admiral King and General Marshall and General Arnold, you know, the way this thing was going to go. Otherwise, there'd be problems. I think the only time Stimson really got, you know, involved in a significant way was about the A-bomb, which, you know and that's it. There wasn't a lot of interference. This guy who came in for Truman basically gutted the services. Wood, I think, was his name. And the first year in Korea was because of that. And then when you look at Vietnam, you got McNamara, who I was in the Air Force, and I don't have to listen to these military guys. I was smarter than all them during the war. And so we saw the disaster that happened there. And then the same goddamn thing with Rumsfeld. You got these guys who they think that they've been appointed as a five-star general, you know, and they get to be, especially Secretary of Defense, especially lately.
Hey, Matt.
Yes. Hold on, Jeff. Jeff, I think you should call Will Sir to make up for.
I did call Will Sir at EI Company when we were in public.
Oh, really? Because I don't know if you heard Will's when I asked Will about that. Will, would you give them?
I did. I listened to it yesterday. I thought you made him do that. You know what I mean?
No, but everybody, hold on. Everybody needs to hear Will's answer about Jeff shows up and the platoon commanders are calling the XO, sir. And so I asked Will about that. Will, what's up? Straight up dick move, right? What's up with having those guys call you sir? And Will's response was?
I just had the presence. I didn't demand it.
They just rendered Caesar what was Caesar's.
Yeah. Let me tell you.
And they also knew. They also knew if they crossed me, I would rat them out to the CO. Yeah. He was a guy that could chew ass. So.
Yeah, he was. This guy who was our CO was the XO of that same company in Beirut.
Holy shit. He had
Will's job in Beirut. And he was the XO of the guy who pulled his pistol out, you know, Captain Johnson, on the Israeli tank. And this guy was the type of guy who would, if you were on your way to step it on your dick, he would sometimes let you do it so he could laugh at you. You know? You remember that, Will?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, hold on. I want to hear the story about Captain Johnson, because I've heard two versions. One, I heard that there was alcohol involved in it. And the other one, I heard it was straight up, you know, being a badass. So
well, me and Will could both tell this because we heard it from Ratliff. But, you know, Will, you go ahead. You you no longer need?
You know, I think that Ratliff thought Johnson was a little bit insane.
Yeah. But he wasn't no drunk, that's for sure.
No. So this Israeli tank is cutting through this Marine Corps, this Marine position in Beirut, and this – is it Captain Ratliff at the time or lieutenant?
No, he's a first lieutenant.
First Lieutenant Ratliff pulls out his .45, right?
No.
Captain Johnson did, the company commander.
Johnson.
Pulls out his .45?
Yeah. Climbed up on the tank.
Oh, okay, that's right. I'm sorry. I'm confused. So Johnson pulls out the .45 and stops the Israeli tank. And let me just tell you the significance of that in my life. I'm working for Merrill Lynch at that time, and I read that article, and I said, that's what fucking men do, and look at me, right?
Yeah, right?
I need to join the Marine Corps, and that's what I fucking did. That's a God's honest. So if you want to know why McNamara joined the Marine Corps, Will,
because a crazy guy pulled a .45 on an Israeli tank.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And then later on, I got told, like, yeah, that guy had been drinking. And I thought, damn it, I didn't know that. That's not part of the story.
That was Blackjack Matthews' battalion, too, by the way.
Oh, well, there you go.
All
right, Jeff, give us a thought about Jim Webb's op-ed.
Well, I liked his stuff. Like, just like Tim said, the guy's a great writer. So he goes through this thumbnail history of the Marine Corps, which is pretty good. I mean, he knows when to put in the significant statistic between when we started in 1775, my Marine Corps came on, to when we started to go to World War I. We only lost 331 guys killed all that time. Yet we had a great reputation. And the Marine Corps really started with the 5th and 6th Marines and the Marine Brigade going into World War I. So he goes through that. He goes through the whole, he rushes through that pretty good. But, I mean, succinctly, like Timmy said. But he gets to the point where the whole point of the little thumbnail history is that we didn't expect to do any of that shit. Excuse me. And we didn't expect to do any of it anywhere it was. And yet, we had enough, in some cases luck, but a lot of cases we had enough of, I guess you'd say a hedge, I think a lot of guys who were in World War I or who were trained right after World War I, guys like, Vandegrift and so forth, they're like, well, we'll probably be in trenches and stuff like that, and we'll probably have to help get back into, but none of them could have imagined, what was going to happen in the Pacific, with the one, island campaign after another. And as he points out, we weren't even the biggest amphib, executors during that time. Actually, the Army was, both in the Pacific and, of course, over in Europe. So, but what he basically is saying is we got to be ready to do the unexpected because it's always the unexpected. It's always nobody in their right mind thought that the Al-Qaeda, this group of yahoos, representing is, the Muslim fundamentalism was going to jet airplanes into these big buildings and massacre thousands of people. That changed everything. And I mean, your imagination's the limit for the type of shit we get into. But it seems to me that the one thing we probably won't get into is the very thing that the force design seems to be prepared for. And it's not, and basically Webb is saying, hey, you got to have a force that can fight. And, if you're only going to put like say you can only put 400 people somewhere, why wouldn't you put two rifle companies and the 81's platoon there? Or, pick from that. Why would you take away all the stuff that you're taking away here in the force design? And not only that, the thing with the Ospreys, you shouldn't, if anything, you should add Osprey squadrons. That thing is a reason we can get around without ships. Those Ospreys and the fucking KC-130s, we can go almost anywhere. Almost anywhere. Now, of course, there's problems with it and everything. But he's getting rid of the very things, that we're going to need in favor of the problem that faces us possibly with the Chinese. And I just think it's just whistling past the graveyard to not hedge your bets on a lot of this stuff. Excuse me.
Good God, man. Are you okay? Coronavirus? What's going on?
Maybe. Maybe. But I'll kick its fucking ass, man. If it is.
That's what they all say.
I'm going to go French kiss Gavin Newsom if I do got it.
I think Jeff is well into the danger cadre there, right? Over the age of 75.
Yes, I am.
The Grim Reaper is screaming his name. Kenny.
I think I already had it, to tell you the truth.
All right, Timmy, any thoughts on Jeff's thoughts?
No, brother, I think we've beaten that one up pretty good. I would like to segue maybe to the Commandant's article.
But before we do that, I wanted to bring something up. Have you ever heard of a guy named Lynn Wells?
Yeah.
So he was a guy. He worked for Rumsfeld, and he wrote Rumsfeld a note about guidance for the QDR in 2001. And I'll find a way to send it to you, Mac. But he basically
explain what the QDR is.
Quadrennial Defense Review. I'm not sure we still do it, but it used to be in law, basically a bottom-up review of the whole DOD. Right. And so he writes Rumsfeld this memo when he talks about if you're the number one security, if you're a security policymaker in the world's greatest power in 1900, 1910, 1920. And basically he shows that you're supposed to be doing something for a 10-year period, and what you were thinking today doesn't look anything like what happens 10 years later. And he closes the memo, and he says, all of which is to say that I'm not sure what 2010 will look like. He's writing this in 2001. But I'm sure it'll be very little like we expect, so we should plan accordingly. And I think that's the essence of Webb's article about the value of the Marine Corps. Balanced, flexible, with depth. And we sort of have a history of innovating, whether it's in the breach or whether it's strategically. Amphibious warfare, vertical lift, all kinds of other things. And so the Commandant seems to be Vision 2030, and it's 2020. He's falling into something that at least this guy points out is probably folly. And it's not necessarily just the Commandant. It's the smart people who wrote all this stuff as a DOD national security strategy and all like that. And again, the idea that you can predict, I mean, on January 1st, could you predict that in less than 6 months, the country would have destroyed its own economy? You couldn't have predicted that.
I kind of sort of did.
Okay.
No, I didn't.
Maybe you should be the one writing these things then.
No.
That's fucking bullshit.
let me give you a thought on that. And Will and I talked about this the other day. Does anybody dispute the fact that there is a requirement to pivot to the Pacific and to return to, you know, giving more thought and more of the budget towards great power competition? I don't think anybody does. I mean, been neglected for the last 18 years.
We pivoted before.
Right.
We get pivoted back.
Right. So Will made this point, but you're not only cutting muscle, you're cutting bone to go all in on a single course of action. So
right.
If somebody would say, hey, you know, we believe in the South China Sea, and in this, you know, three MEF needs to tilt to this, you know, two MEF's going to be a swing MEF, but one MEF's going to still be the heavy, thunderous right hook, you know, put the tanks in the reserves, you know, all three battalions, we'll call them out when we need them, you know, blah, blah. I mean, to me, that kind of intellectual, you know, rigor, you know, and the Marine Corps morphing into and out of the things that it has historically, you know, morphed in and out of, is what the Marine Corps has always been for the nation. And so to me, I don't understand all in before anybody else even has a foot in. And that's what it, and to me, that's what it seems like he's done. And I think, you know, I think Secretary Webb's paper is written at people on Capitol Hill. I think I think it's written at the new to the new SecNav, and I think it lays out, you know, aside from his, you know, he's getting his his dagger out. I think it's written in the lexicon of what has made the Marine Corps great and of great utility to the nation, and so. But that's the question mark of this is why is the Marine Corps all in when nobody else is even in? And Will teased our discussion the other day about force design by saying, look, inside the Pentagon, it's not just about the money, okay? It's only about the money, or right, words to that effect. So.
You know, I think, you know, Webb said, you know, we're throwing over all these proven military thinkers like Gray, and he goes backwards from Gray, Vandegrift, you know, Lejeune and people like that. But for this college guy, for this, you know, professor, you know, he doesn't even name the guy. But, you know, we did have this guy, Ellis, you know, who really believed that it was going to be Japan was going to be the problem in the Far East there, and that we needed to be able to do the stuff that failed in Gallipoli and a little bit there in Northwestern Europe, you know, in the First World War. He bet his life on it. Ultimately, he's drunk and everything. We know all those stories, but he went out there and he actually did some good work. And you don't see, there's nobody saying this is, you know, I've been out there in the South China Sea, and I see this, I see the future, and this is how you got to do this stuff. It's not, it's just not there. You know what I mean? It's not there. And it's like, the chances, and we've pivoted to the Pacific before. When I first came in the Marine Corps in 1975, that's all, you know, I mean, I'd get the Marine Corps, I'd get the Gazette from the library and read it. And also Leatherneck, which is, you know, like a kid's magazine, but they would always say, yeah, and the commandant himself said it, General Wilson, we're pulling our heads out of the jungle and getting back in the amphibious business. And almost immediately, you know, we were getting pulled away from, you know, the Pacific region. You know, once we pulled out of Vietnam, we never really
right,
went
but
back.
But Webb's point is we've always been faithful to this agile force that's cost effective, and we'll get there and fight tonight, and we'll bring a chain with us when we come.
And you know, you're right, and everybody understands that the best way to do this is embarked Marines on naval shipping. And when we first started doing the MEUs, I mean, they always had this thing called MAUs, you know, but when they started doing the MEUs, when we first started going out with them, there were five ships. And you had a lot of flexibility. You could do split arg ops and stuff, and we did a lot of crap. I mean, the only MEU I was ever on that didn't do something real was the first one that Will and I went on, which, by the way, was great for training because we hardly spent more than a week and a half at a time in the ship, you know, except for the translant. But the rest of the time, there was always something going on.
Yeah, but now the whole premise of all of this is that MEU configuration is a thing of the past.
Yeah.
It belongs in the, you know, the National Museum of the Marine Corps.
And that's not for – that's no decision anyone made. That's public. It's just the Navy is running out of amphibs because they don't give a shit about them.
All right.
Hey, brother Matt, I would say two things on this. When I'll know we're actually all in the Pacific when the A team is in 3MEF and everyone there is on a regular 3-year tour in a UDP back to 29 Palms. So the commandant can control that through personnel assignment policy, but like it or not, 3MEF is a B team. And the second thing Jeff may or may not remember this, talking about force design and force structure. When we were at TBS, General Krulak came to
We talked about that, Will.
The fist rig, the force structure review group. And as we sat in the room, he goes through all the things that we weren't going to look at. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we're going to reorganize this way. And Jeff said at that time, he fenced the fat.
Yeah.
Hey, we're not going to cut the fat. And I'll tell you something. When we were doing the force structure review when I was in the assistant commandant's office, I remember that conversation very well.
Yeah.
And it's hard to get the institutional Marine Corps to look at the fat. And, okay, what's the fat? Well, when you cut three infantry battalions and the Marine Security Guard battalion doesn't take a cut, you just fence the fat.
Yep.
And so then we're going to – I fear on this, we're going to pay bills with muscle and bone. Once you take force structure out, you cannot get it back. It will not come back until there's major contingency. It ain't coming back, and we're going to be stuck with a lot of accoutrements, but no Christmas tree to hang them on, because there's not enough battalions, there's not enough squadrons, and there's not enough real tactical logistics support to do it. So,
let me ask you a question, Timmy. You wanted to hop in.
Well, I wanted the transition because we're in a unique position of having the commandant put out an article and to evaluate. And I wanted to segue into that because I don't understand the goddamn article. I swear to God, when you start reading about interstate strategic competition as yardsticks by which to measure the adequacy of what we have today, I get confused. But I'm interested to hear what you guys think of that thing. But before we go there, the one observation I think is salient now is we don't know what China's going to be in next year, as Will was just saying. But what we know is that they locked down at the same time they're allowing people to fly out of the country. They couldn't fly to Peking or Beijing, but they could fly to L.A. They locked down for 3 weeks like that and are responsible for the spread of this virus. And right now today, they're violating the low-yield nuclear trust test treaty by testing low-yield nukes. They're renaming islands in the South China Sea. They're aggressively pushing back on the narrative about their responsibility. They don't seem repentant in the least. And if you start talking these gray zone operations, I believe they're 10 years into them already. We seem to be behind the curve. I just wanted to say that before I listen to you guys explain to me what the hell the commandant was trying to say, because I don't understand what he was getting at.
Before we go there, they
admitted they put over 300,000 combat troops supporting Vietnam between 65 and 70. Did you see that?
I sent that. Yeah. I was looking that up because in these battlefield studies I've been doing, and the one that aired today was awesome. I mean, it was. Oh my God, this guy is an Alpha 19. They do Operation Buffalo. They stay out, and then they get sent north with a recon team. So the recon team they don't know how the NVA are getting across the Benhai River so fast. And so they go up there and they hop into this, you know, company, maybe battalion, NVA battalion, defensive position on this piece of high ground with good fields of fire. So they hop in the holes. There's a Soviet style zigzag trench, and this guy's a lance corporal, squad leader. He goes out and he's the LPOP out there, and the recon guys, they go out to look at the river and they yell, "Holy shit!" Right? "Holy shit! There's a battalion walking your way right now." Right? And so they waste a battalion. I mean, they're in the admin mode. You know, heavy weapons slung under bamboo, women with chickens strapped to their back, that kind of shit, talking, laughing, smoking and joking. And he tells a story about them just wasting, you know, he said it was unbelievable. But Yeah, so in my course of these discussions, especially fighting the NBA near the DMZ up in Leatherneck Square, I mean, these guys all say the same thing. Yeah, we killed a lot of Chinese, and then Timmy talks about his dad. But here's my question. There was an article that came out about the amphib ships, and I'll attach this to Secretary Webb's article in terms of, the narrowness of, the Commandant's force design that he's very critical of. And it says that each ship, 30 ships, will have a crew of 40 sailors and a company of 75 Marines. That's 2,235 Marines. So they're the guys with the Tomahawk missiles. Where's everybody else? If the Mew can't get near them, right, where's everybody else? And if you can only get limited numbers into the region, what's the sense of everybody else being uber light infantry and not being able to, if that's the bottleneck you're going to fight through? And that's right. What we believe. I don't understand why the rest of the Marine Corps is configured like that small segment if that's the bottleneck you're going to go through. Thoughts? Mueller? Anybody? Bueller. Mueller.
30 times 75 is 2250, not 2235. Other than that.
Nice.
Good.
You forgot the that's bullshit.
Yeah, and again, the point I made the other day with those ships, they're 200 feet long. Where are they coming from?
Yeah. They're on somebody's design board.
Again, but you still got to put people in them and sail them from point A to point B.
Well, I think you got to fund the son of a bitches first and get them approved.
Yeah. I think that's our bottleneck, because the one thing he's got right is the reduced amount of money he's going to have in the years from now on going forward. Again, we don't know how bad we're going to be hurt from this COVID-19 thing. So he's got that right. But that reduced amount of funds, that might start. I don't see him getting this past Congress. I just don't see it.
Maybe the whole thing is like there's some toys that the congressmen, in the House and in the Senate are too powerful to screw with. That's why we got all the F-35 still. That's where we got other, that's where we got the Marine security guard guys still. And then there's others that you can. So the ones that can be messed with are messed with. And you end up with this, illogical mixture of things like Tim, Will was saying, it's a lot of, as they say in Texas, right, Timmy? It's a lot of hat and no cattle,
Yep, that's exactly right.
All right. Timmy, the floor is yours.
Oh, well, I was trying to cue up Will and Jeff to explain to me what the Commandant was trying to say. I right now I'm not that worried about this reorganization, because I don't see it happening given the unknowns that are out there. To include what are the impacts on China? China's going to be taking a gigantic hit as people start to adjudicate what happened. So I'm pretty confident that this radical change is not going to happen. But there's nothing I read in the Commandant's article in the Marine Corps Gazette which in any way justified anything to me. It just kind of confused me and gave me a queasy feeling, because if everything's validated by war games, I don't think that's validation. unless you're fighting Van Riper, in which case I might buy it.
Yeah, I read that article. I'm trying to I sent it to Mac, even though he already had it, right, from my military account. I don't have it on my goddamn AOL. But yeah, it's AOL. But the whole thing is like it's poorly put forward. Like, you understood what General Gray was talking about. You understood what General Wilson and General Barrow were talking about. They talked about changes in the Marine Corps, but like Will was saying about the thing with General Krulak, they had Marty Steele, General Steele, come and try and push us this thing that Will was talking about. And just didn't – even the dumb people, could see that it just didn't make sense. They had this thing called the what was the name of that outfit out in 29 Palms? Instead of 7th Marines, you're going to have the Combined Arms Regiment.
Combined Arms Regiment. The car.
And Colonel Steele, I mean, or then he was a colonel, I think. I don't know if he was a general yet.
Yeah.
He had the unenviable task of saying, and the XO, this is where he made his mistake, the XO is going to be an F-18 pilot because they think faster than everybody else. I don't know if you remember that. So he was hooted. I mean, and he's a good guy, Marty Steele, if you know him. Right. You know?
Right. No, he's a good guy.
Yeah. But I'm like, man, the fucking Commandant fucked you. But it was almost as bad as the year before, and the Commandant was still at Quantico, McSittick. He tried to push us doing away with – he wanted us to voluntarily do away with peer evals because the females were getting – they're always ranked last because they were the – they couldn't keep up and they couldn't carry shit, all that stuff. You remember that one too? And
I absolutely remember that. And,
yeah.
Yep. I remember it well, and as well as evaluations, instructor evaluations, because the female instructors were always rated down. That was a big deal.
To reinforce what Tim said, so I didn't pay a lot of attention to this force design thing. And in the last week or so, I've read a lot of stuff on it. And it's gobbledygook.
Yeah.
I read the Commandants. There's a thing on a website, War on the Rocks, publishes a lot of New Age thinking stuff. And that's where Hamas is on.
Right.
Other sources and even the articles that acknowledge the gobbledygook continue with more gobbledygook.
Uh-huh.
And things don't need to be, understood by a caveman. But the degree of over sophistication, and I'll tell you the other thing that if you've ever read Black Swan or Fooled by Randomness, that guy has a very powerful message, and it's just because you don't think it can happen doesn't mean it can't happen. And we have this confirmation bias that we're looking for something, we see it. So therefore, we must be right, as opposed to skepticism. And the Marine Corps should be the most skeptical of anything and anyone. For one, as Max said the other day, the nation's always going to have an Army, Navy, and an Air Force. Doesn't necessarily have to have a Marine Corps. And the second thing is, warfare is a humbling experience. You are going to be surprised. And your ability to win is based on how you can react, and that's a function of flexibility and depth. That's how you can overcome that black swan event, that completely unexpected thing. And over-reliance on technology and gobbledygook, I don't know. I spent time studying foreigners, went to graduate school, learned a language. One thing I learned is you can never truly understand a foreigner because they're foreign. Our ability to truly understand the Chinese, anybody want to make a wager in a very positive way on where they're going, I'll almost always take the counter wager because we just don't know. We got to be flexible.
Right. Yeah, it's
Let me give you two thoughts about the Commandant's article. The thing that I when I read it, the things that boom through my head, and the same thing when I read Webb's and all these, is what Colonel Kantsian wrote about the high rate of predictive failure throughout history.
Which, there you go.
Right? And so to me, and Kantsian's article, and so I have that in my head, okay? And then the other thing that I have booming in my head, and this just comes from my personal experiences as people have reached out to me because, I've done this for 4 years. I've interviewed a lot of people, and I know a lot of people. And there's nobody that's coming to the Commandant's aid of note in the Marine Corps. Nobody. Right. And that's disturbing because I can tell you, you know, when the maneuver warfare, you know, thing got going, I mean, you had, you know, you had big hitters in the Marine Corps go to bat for it. And I remember Zinni when he came to the basic school, you know, saying, you know, the chief of staff then of the 3rd Marine Division, right, General Von Ripper, right, called me in and said, Zinni, we don't give a shit how many sand table and map exercises you do it up there at 9th Marines. We're going to actually do this shit, all right, and we're going to find out if it works or not. And, you know, and so you had those kind of guys, I mean, like, we're all over this intellectual endeavor. To me, the thing that is most concerning, and I when I can't help thinking about it when I read the Commandant stuff, is that retired senior Marines and active duty senior Marines I spoke to said, we've been fenced out of this.
Right.
Nobody's listening. And so to me, the Commandant's put himself in a position where he's kind of sawed it off and he's out there alone and probably unafraid, right? But he doesn't have anybody there with him. And when you do that, I have this saying in my head, when you're out there like that, you're either one of two things. You're a genius or you're an idiot, right? And so because the best way to go is to go there with brilliant people. And as Timmy said, if I'm going to war game something – and PK Van Riper is not a part of it, then I'm not going to sleep well at night. Because I want him there ripping that shit apart, pulling it apart, and then throwing it back together and ripping everybody a new ass. And when he looks at me and says, hey, I think you got something here, then I'm like, all right, everybody can breathe now. But it doesn't seem like that's where this has gone. It hasn't gone down the road of the intellectual river rigor of the most senior experienced guys that we have in this culture. And to right. me, that I don't, you know, and so I read what the Commandant says.
I would say too, when you go back and reread FMFM1, you know, Warfighting, it is a very well-written, understandable, logical, convincing argument. And, you know, Tim led off this part of the discussion with, I don't understand what he's talking about.
Right.
And I've got to tell you, on a micro tactical level, I can see some of it, but I don't see how it integrates. And then my own experience with the Navy is I don't get it. And the Commandant even starts the thing out with, you know, he says, the question is, what does the Navy need from the Marine Corps? Well, that's a dumbass question.
Thank you.
It's
why?
What does the joint force? How do we fit into? How do we integrate with? What's our piece, and how do we complement the other pieces? Because if you ask the Navy what they need from the Marine Corps, they need guys to guard nuclear weapons.
Yeah, it's like you said yesterday, Mac, the new guy, when he was getting grilled, I was listening to your thing when I was walking the dog. He didn't mention the Marine Corps. He mentioned General Mattis, but he didn't mention the Marine Corps. You know, when he's talking about how he's going to, you know, lead his prospective force.
Hold on. So when Jeff says, when you're talking about the new guy, he means the Secretary of the Navy designate.
What's his name? Bruce Finn or something like that. You know, what is the Marine Corps asked from the Navy for the past 50 years?
More amphibs.
And what have we gotten?
Nothing.
A kick in the shins. So because we didn't get what we needed to do our naval campaign and mission, we're just going to acquiesce and now ask what they need from us. And we will become what Truman said that we were, you know.
Navy's police force.
Yeah. Because how many Navy, senior Navy leaders, junior Navy leaders? I mean, Jeff, how many amphibs have you been on where the CO of the ship really understood what we were about? There are
not
some.
Many.
But
less
they are
and less
an exception.
As time goes by. Now it's like it's a way an aviator can get, you know, they got to have two ship commands. They give them one amphib. You know, if he's like a junior 06, he gets a LPD or even an LSD. If he's a senior 06,
he'll get like a LHD or one of the big, you know, big decks. That's all we got.
Yeah. I was out there with ship's captains that understood what the business was, but I was out there with a whole lot of them and a whole lot of junior officers that had no flipping idea what the mission of the ship was.
So, and that's an art form, that fucking amphib ship. I mean, you know, doing that constant reconciliation between the flight deck and the well deck and the, you know, sea state necessary for launching things and the whole nine, all their extra safety stuff they constantly put on. It's really difficult to do the simplest amphib op.
Well, and I hate to make something sound worse than it actually is, but
no, you don't.
Somebody, as somebody who was around OneMap for a few years, when you go to the, and I'm not going to give away anything classified here, you know, that's not common knowledge, that when you would go, you know, through the weekly ops intel brief, blah, 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 and you'd see, you know, the amphib readiness that supports OneMap. I mean, not only did they not give us any ships, the one that they have, right, weren't maintained, couldn't go to sea, couldn't support training. And that was what you heard every week. Oh, yeah, they haven't received this part, can't get to sea, won't be able to participate in this exercise. You know, and it was just so not being committed to the amphibious Navy is more ships is one thing. You know, the lack of readiness, you know,
Well, I have to tell you, a major part of my education in Lima Company 3-8, and I had never been involved in any of this before. This guy Ratliff and then Will, right? One of the main things you got to do is work with the Navy like they're a foreign force. Like, for instance, there's a point where you go up there before you actually go on float with these guys and you sign the ship's regs. You got to drive a hard bargain on the ship's regs. I write down how many people, what's the ratio going to be for working parties to clear the flight deck during underway replenishments, because that's how you use your leverage to maintain your combat edge, because they will fuck you otherwise, excuse my French. And I don't know if you remember, Will, there was a constant, you know, and what it was in our ship was the Spartanburg County for that. It was LST. Will was the dick. And Captain Ratliff was like the Lord, who only when things got too bad, where they couldn't stand anymore, they would come and see Captain Ratliff. And it was all choreographed to our advantage. And I did the same thing when I was the CO of troops on the USS Portland. All that I learned from, you know, from Captain Ratliff and from Will being on there. And the whole thing about being the CO of troops was you make your Marines' lives infinitely more bearable being on the fucking boat, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and but more
the point
ready
of that
combat.
Too is that the Navy doesn't embrace,
right,
the Marine Corps.
No.
So why does the Commandant think the Navy's going to embrace us now? It's those are like big service level strategic things. It's hard for me to get two levels down in the design stuff because, like Tim, it's hard for me to understand what the hell they're talking about. But on the biggest issue,
and we know how to do timing and headspace, and we know how to do the aiming circle and lay in a gun line. I know I'm not that bright, but I'm smart enough to. They should be able to tell me the force design so I can understand it.
Yeah,
and there's something else too, Mac.
Webb is basically saying as well,
right?
That we have history. He says take a conservative attitude.
Go ahead, Timmy.
Hey, man. When I wanted to go back to the Zinni thing because I've thought about it since you've mentioned it frequently. I think Will was there the night that he did that. But if you remember, he was criticizing us. He was talking about how we taught tactics when he was going with it was hysterical. I never saw an assembly area. I didn't know what the line, you know, going through all that stuff. Which for us IOC instructors we were reveling in that. But it was. It was controversial and done in such a manner that it didn't offend anybody. Cause I mean, he had Van Riper there and whatnot, but that was a wake up call for you, Matt, for all of us, because we're like, holy shit. Cause here's a guy that's preaching what the new commandant Al Gray was talking about. eloquently defending the thing in terms that all of us could see was the truth. I mean, and it's impossible for anybody to do that with what General Berger's given us to date. There is, it's inconceivable a smart colonel could come out of Okinawa and sit down at TBS and explain this in a way that, I mean, I've rarely laughed harder in my life than that night at that damn thing. I've got that tape that you gave me all those years ago, Mac. I've listened to it frequently over the years. That shit was funny and it was right and it was smart. And we learned, and you can't do that with what the comrades got.
Hey, that just so you know, you can watch the video. It's on. I put it up on YouTube.
Oh, cool! I'll go watch it. That damn thing is hysterical.
No, Zinni is. I mean, and that's where for me he became the burning bush. And then I saw him again, but he wasn't playing the Ginzo from Philly. You know what I mean? He was being the intellectual because the environment was different. And I was like, wait a minute, I want like the Ginzo from Philly, the guy right in at the basic school. And that's why, I mean, and what I learned from him is that he's one of those guys, and Webb has a lot of similar qualities, right? In that Webb plays the range of the communication spectrum. He knows how to play the audience, and I mean gifted with the English language. Right. I told the story, I think, with Will the other day, that he came down in the Mardet on the Ranger when he came out in 1987. He rolls up his sleeve and he says, yeah, not only am I the first Secretary of the Navy, but I know I'm the first to have one of these. And it's a tattoo. Sunset. Yeah. With a tattoo with a sunset and a girl. It says USMC, and he says, got this in Padilla Beach in what? When would you have gone? 1968 or 67?
Probably, yeah. 69 is when he was over there.
Right. And he said, I'm the only son of a bitch who's got one of these. And the Marines went nuts, right?
I talked to lieutenants at TV at IOC breakfast. And I'll never forget it. Let me put it that way.
No, but Zinni, and so Zinni to me, I mean, and he was pressing all of our buttons that night, selling us on a way to think, right? A way to think, and I mean, he busted everybody balls. He looks at Van Riper, and everybody scared shitless of Van Riper, and he was Marine Corps University at the time, if I remember, and he's sitting over there, right? The most uptight white guy in the world. I mean, at least that's what we thought. And Timmy and I and Jeff have always said that, you know what. We didn't really understand Van Riper, and kind of embarrassing now in retrospect that we didn't. But, you know, he talks about having Van Riper, Bill Fike, and John Ripley come to a warrior night at 9th Marines in Okinawa. And then Zinni says, they called one the Prussian, they called another one the surfer, and they called the third one the philosopher. And with that, he looks over at Van Riper and he says, don't wax your board, General. Right, yeah. And the whole place, right, the whole place falls out laughing, and the whole night, right, he busted Bill Lynn's balls every chance he got.
Well, that's good,
right? Which I mean, but he was playing to us, right?
Yeah.
He was playing to us that he knew that we were pissed at Bill Lynn, but there was valid criticism in what Bill Lynn had to say. But there was so much other bullshit in it. And so, I mean, so to me, I just remember going home that night, like, what was that? Who was that? And that's what I want to be in some way, shape, or form, a guy like that who can articulately question what we do. And I, you know, again, I have to say the same thing. I look at this and it leaves me head scratching that we would be all in, right? And as Will's talked about the money. Right, the ships aren't conceived, the ships aren't designed, the ships aren't funded, and we're not saying, well, we're going to put all of our tanks, we're going to phase into this. Phase one is, you know, legacy systems go to the reserve, all right? If we need them, we could pull them out. We'll replace those with army tanks, right? And that's how we'll manage this thing until you know, these ships come online and we can divest ourselves. And you'd see this thing that made sense to you relative to money, relative to the range of military operations. But it doesn't do that. I mean, it's like we're all in and Will said something to me. He said, look, if the Navy has a chance to fuck you for money, come over here, girl. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to happen. And I've heard, if I heard that from one, I've heard that from a dozen people. Yeah. And so, I don't know.
But you know, who, like Dave will tell you, all his time in OLA, his main job is trying to winkle amphibs out of the Navy, you know, and find money to do it. And it's just harder than it should be. Because, you know, like some of the O plans, all the O plans that we're involved in have us coming in there with tanks and shitloads of arty and stuff like that. And now, I guess, I mean, that's the other thing about this, and you kind of touched on it, Mac. What's the national strategy? How does the national strategy, how do we fit into that? I don't see that, because it'd be, it's revolutionary, and yet they don't really seem to be, I haven't, no, is there a national strategy? Has it been put out? You know?
No, my problem in that, if you look at this, and even if you, and this is what I find would be an interesting thing to discuss. Would Marines be better used as coast watchers and target acquisition guys, or as shooters of tomahawks? You could shoot tomahawks from anywhere. You could shoot them from Australia. You can shoot. I mean, you could shoot them all. Would you? You know. And so, to me, if once we cut all the undersea cables, right? Once we blow out all the satellites, now what?
That's fight time.
Find me a target.
Yeah.
Find me a target, yeah. And the answer is, how do you find a target? Nobody's explained that to me.
Well, I think that's gray zone ops, and I believe that that gray zone is full of Chinese citizens. So I think they can find targets.
Will, how do we find the target? Will, you're a smart guy. Went to Monterey. Yeah,
reconnaissance and force.
Oh yeah,
you
but we
have
don't
force to be able to do it.
We don't close with anymore, so that would be the Army Rangers.
You know, and Mac, that you've almost come to it a couple of times. Even if there is a strategy, has the strategy been articulated in the war plans? Because plans provide the demand signal for the services, and the war plans, if you stack them all on top of each other, you know, you need a Marine Corps of like eight brigades doing forcible entry, not one or two. And so it is interesting, the job of the service chief, organize, train, equip. So you are responding to the requirements of the war plans, I think. And we seem, you know, I don't know how we have prioritized, assuming that SINC-PAC has come up with some new war plan that this is the requirement, and that's the one we've chosen. Because in the end, you can't actually, I don't think you can fulfill all the requirements out there. So the service is balancing what they're able to do. And so, you know, it's unfortunate that we're sort of on the outside. But if we're on the inside, we wouldn't be able to talk about it anyhow. When I just try and think through how things work, flowing, you know, NSC and into the SecDef's office and with the COCOMs and with OSD policy, and how that flows into the services through the secretaries and then through the uniforms, this seems odd to me. And that doesn't mean it didn't happen, but it was not my experience sort of seeing this stuff reasonably up close. And that's part of my argument, is just, I don't understand. I don't understand the gobbledygook, and I don't understand the process that we're part of right now. Because if this thing had logically like that,
which answers the question, where did this come from? Where did these requirements come from?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they say a civilian agency, like, remember they reeled off a couple of acronym or initial things that I didn't get those, like, you know, oh, and I mean, do you remember that? Lieutenant Colonel Cuomo, I think, he, you know, said we've been directed by, you know, organization in DOD, you know.
Right. But again, it's very vague, I've been, but I mean, I got asked that straight up. Where does this come from? is this, right. are these the requirements of the COCOMs? And I said, I don't, it doesn't
and,
sound
and
like
I would say that you know, the
are.
Last thing that whoever's in charge of change management is failing, right? Yeah. In the business world, I've had to do some significant changes. And the idea that you're going to force stuff down people's throats, it doesn't work in the military, and it doesn't work in the civilian world. And so the commandant, maybe he is attempting to get going on change management, but he's got a lot of change management to do, most importantly on the Hill, because they are going to vote with the Alumni Association, with people in academia, with the active duty force. There are a lot of, and the word stakeholder, unfortunately, buzzword, there's a lot of stakeholders in this that I think are feeling ignored. And if you want to have a successful change, one of your change management strategies is not to ignore significant stakeholders. And it's not clear. Maybe he thinks that he puts this article here. He's got these different people writing stuff. But it's not obvious to me that his change management strategy is working. And I reflect back to the force structure that General Conway started and General Amos finished in like 2011. I got to tell you something. That was a good 25 to 33% of the commandant's time was at change management. You know, personal meetings with all the service secretaries, with all the people in OSD, to include the secretary, with the other service chiefs, with every major command and station. And part of his change management strategy was people involved in that thing were – all the GOs out there sent their colonel to it, and they got to have the throwdown in the meeting room, knowing that in the end, whatever we come out with, we're going to come out with a united front on. And I thought it made a lot of sense just how the structure came out, but also the fact that everybody had skin in it inside the Marine Corps. And to include all retired GOs, you know, he convened a retired general officer symposium, invited every single retired GO to come to it.
Wow.
And that was a big part of it. And General Amos knew, I mean, we were getting cut. We were at 207,000 active duty at that point, and we were coming down. And what he was trying to do is not go down to 140. Which there's a whole lot of people were voting for that.
Right.
And he built a very, a force structure that he war gamed against the war plans. So it was completely supportable by the war plans. And I wish there would have been some other changes, but I give him credit too, in that he did it in 3 months. So he war gamed against the war plans. So if someone was going to throw a rock at it, okay, what's your intellectual basis for doing it? But he worked hard on change management.
Well, you know,
the genesis.
The other component of that, and we saw it the other day as we listened to the hearing that Secretary Designate Brathwaite went through, right? One of the ways the Navy is going to pay, or at least in theory is going to pay for some of this stuff, is there, you know, they weren't going to buy one of the two submarines this year, right? And you had Senator Blumenthal, right?
Yeah.
Down his throat, you know, and so with the Marine Corps is just going to opt out of how many F-35s? Yeah, we're not going to buy those. Oh, really? Do you think that's how it works? And the answer to that is that's not how it works. And so it'll be interesting to see, you know, how this all settles out. I know that this plan, you know, I read that it was delivered to, you know, the chairman and you know, the Secretary of Defense. I have yet to see anything where they have come back and said,
right,
they blessed this and that, yeah, this is the way forward. And again, what I hear from retired general officers is, hey, when we become this narrow and we miss a fight, stand by to see your funding, you know, to get to get reduced, you know, and then the Marine Corps will be the Navy's handmaiden.
Yeah.
So, all right. We've been going for about an hour and 13 minutes. Final thoughts, Timmy.
I just wanted to real quick say something. Lost a friend here yesterday. Lala Khan was a tribal leader in Nangarhar Province who had worked with us during a community development program targeted by ISIS suicide bombers. That's a second close friend of mine I've lost in the last 2 years, specifically to ISIS. And I wanted to put a plug in for a book, a guy by the name of Chris Courtson.
Wait, hold on. So was that the funeral that we read about?
That was the funeral, right. It was the funeral in Nangarhar province for a police chief that was killed up in Kabul.
Okay, so and that is ISIS event?
That was ISIS. That was ISIS going after Lala Khan, yeah.
Because
that guy, is that guy a Afridi or a Durrani, Tim? No,
he's up from Dari Noor. He's a Pashi, bro. Yeah, he's... Okay. He's a Pashi mafia guy. He's out of Dari Noor province. His dad was a big leader. Good guy. He helped us out a lot. He was a friend of the Afghan people. Honest guy. He helped us recover a couple $100,000 that went missing once. I mean, the guy was a stand-up a friend of the Afghan people and ours. And the story about that, there's a guy named Chris Courtson who I worked with in Afghanistan who just published a book, self-published, called 3,000 Days in Afghanistan. And it describes it's an interesting read if you know something about Afghanistan, because Chris isn't a self-promoter, so he lists all these things we've done in all these contested provinces during 2010-2011 fighting season, and it's hard to understand what it is that was accomplished because Chris just isn't the guy to toot his horn. But in the outside the wire contractor, you know, guys that I worked with them in our project, the guys that worked outside the wire, local clothes, local cars, low profile, heavily armed. He was the best there ever was. And he's a former Army Civil Affairs officer, 10 years in Nangarhar province. The guy was I call him the John Paul Vann of Afghanistan. And it's an interesting book if you guys I just wanted to plug that.
Got it. Jeff, final thought?
Well, you know, we're talking about General Van Riper, and Will's on the program with us now. And, you know, when I left 2nd Marine Division to go up to Quantico, General Van Riper had just left there himself as the CO of the or CG of the 2nd Mar Div, and we were all scared of him because he's General Van Riper. So I get up there, and Will says, "Your first assignment is to do a stack display with your guys for General Van Riper's guys from I think it was Lima 37 or no, Mike 37 or something like
that. Mike 37, yeah."
Yeah, his rifle company in Vietnam. So I'm like, he's going to look at me and fire me. Or he's going to fire me because my guys were good Marines. You know, they're really great weaponeers too, you know. But, you know, we had issues. And we would do such things as stake out the parking lot by range control because we thought guys were coming in to sell dope to our guys from there. Remember that, Will?
Oh, yeah.
So Will had me do that. I'll tell you, General Van Riper shows up in a T-shirt and slacks. You know, he was totally, you know, it was a whole nother look into the guy, you know, other than that. And then later on, we had his kid go through IOC, and he comes out to – we were going to have him do the fireside chat, and it was during Whoopluff, you know. And the first day, it was that afternoon running, you know, they get set up there, and the next morning they run the second one. But we were going. His kid was a salt guy, and they were going across that pond there by R7, and he slipped and broke his leg. So he gets the stick and he hobbles the rest of the way. Watches the kid. You know, they shoot a couple smalls.
Wait! Who broke their leg, General Van Riper or the kid?
General Van Riper.
Holy
General
shit.
Van Riper. And then we had him that night come to a mucus meeting we had, and he gets there and he's like 2 minutes late, and he says, "I'm usually always 10 minutes early for everything I go to. But the fucking guys at IOC broke my leg this afternoon."
That's funny. Will, final thought?
I don't want to keep you guys up too late. You should be gumming your applesauce and drinking your warm milk and going to bed. So
that's Timmy.
I appreciate it, though.
First of all, it's great having Will here. As I tell people, we've been doing this since about 1990, 91. And you know, and I think probably my biggest concern of everything I've heard, and whether it be Secretary Webb's article or the Commandant's article, that there hasn't been this free fire zone of ideas and information that he didn't convene, you know, a council of retired generals. That there doesn't seem to be, you know, this incredible, vibrant discussion about the future of the Marine Corps. That it was, you know, here, take this son of a bitch, go do it. And that's, you know, to me, that's the biggest concern, because an organization that lives like that intellectually, it's not good. It's not good. So anyway, boys, thank you very much. Will, welcome to the Lynch, Kenny, and Vito show. And thanks for doing this.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks.
All right. There you have it. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.
Hi, this is Mike McNamara.
There you have it. Yeah, a blast from the past. Will Cosentini joined us. Will, as you could tell, Will is a smart guy. And you know, and he has experiences. And what's cool about having him involved is he has experiences that the rest of us don't have. You know, he worked inside, if you listen to an interview we did the other day, worked inside the E-ring, which is the outer ring of the Pentagon, where all the service secretaries have their offices, and the uniform chiefs of services have their offices and whatnot. And so so he's seen that level where the rest of us have not. And he's a smart guy. Like I said, we've been doing this forever. I mean, we know one way to do things, and that is to argue about it, to ask hard questions, and then get smart people in to talk and footnote answers, you know, and get as close to you can as truth. And I want to share before I end this thing today, you know, like I said, Will's a smart guy. He alluded to the Lynn Wells memo to Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld in 2001. It was forwarded by Secretary Rumsfeld to the President of the United States. And let me see. What I'm looking at is April 12th, 2001. So, right, this is the April prior to September 11th. And the Secretary of Defense forwards it to the President. He CCs the Vice President and the National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice. Subject, predicting the future. You will recall that we had Andy Marshall come over and we briefly discussed the defense strategy review and what the future might hold. I ran across this piece on the difficulty of predicting the future, written by one of the folks here at the Pentagon, Lynn Wells. His name actually, Linton Wells. I thought you might find it interesting, respectfully. And this is from Lynn Wells, right? And it's entitled Thoughts on the 2001 Quadrennial Defense Review. And it's a series of bullets that I'll read to you. If you had been a security policymaker in the world's greatest power in 1900, you would have been a Brit, looking warily at your age-old enemy, France. By 1910, you would be allied with France, and your enemy would be Germany. By 1920, World War I would have been fought and won. You'd be engaged in a naval arms race with your erstwhile allies, the U.S. and Japan. By 1930, the naval arms limitation treaties were in effect. The Great Depression was underway, and the defense planning standard was, quote, no war for 10 years, close quote. 9 years later, World War II would begin. By 1950, Britain no longer was the world's greatest superpower. The atomic age has dawned and a police action was underway in Korea. 10 years later, the political focus was on the missile gap. the strategic paradigm was shifting from massive retaliation to flexible response, and few people had heard of Vietnam. By 1990, the peak of our involvement in, by 1970, the peak of our involvement in Vietnam had come and gone. We were beginning détente with the Soviets, and we were anointing the Shah of Iran as our protege in the Gulf region. By 1980, the Soviets were in Afghanistan. Iran was in the throes of a revolution. There was talk of our hollow forces and a window of vulnerability, and the U.S. was the greatest creditor nation the world had ever seen. By 1990, the Soviet Union was within a year of dissolution. American forces in the desert were on the verge of showing they were anything but hollow. The U.S. had become the greatest debtor nation in the world had ever known, and almost no one had heard of the Internet. 10 years later, the year 2000, Warsaw was the capital of a NATO nation. Asymmetric threats transcended geography, and parallel revolutions of information, biotechnology, robotics, nanotechnology, and high-density energy sources foreshadowed changes almost beyond forecasting. All of which is to say that I'm not sure what 2010 will look like, but I'm sure that it will be very little like what we expect. So we should plan accordingly. So, thanks to Will Cosentini for bringing that to our attention. It's included in the post of this hour if you'd like to share it with anybody. Because it's straight up wisdom. Straight up wisdom. And so when you're thinking about the narrow force that the Marine Corps will be, it flies in the face of Marine Corps history, and it certainly flies in the face of a memo that has a lot of wisdom in it, written in 2001, in April of 2001, by Linton Wells, about what the future would look like relative to the Quadrennial Defense Review. So, that's a mouthful. All right. With all that said, if you're just tuning in, don't touch that dial. Hour one continues. I'll share an op-ed, an opinion piece in the Washington Post about, and really, how does President Obama essentially and I'm trying to figure out a way to articulate this. How can it be anything other than become the ringmaster of a conspiracy against the Trump administration using the FBI and the Justice Department? How does that happen? How do they not believe in the American system? So it's pretty interesting. So talk about that in hour one and check the news. So have a great day on a Thursday. All Marine Radio over and out.